I'm John Kroll. Today, on this special recorded No Limits, we're going to talk with three members of the Speed City chapter of Sisters in Crime about a new play they're producing, a new anthology, and more generally about the enduring appeal of mystery writing. My guests are Michael Dabney, president of the Speed City chapter of Sisters in Crime, Crystal Rhodes, a member of the chapter, and Diana Catt, a board member for the chapter. Because this is a recorded No Limits, we're not able to take phone calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you will enjoy the conversation. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. This is a recorded No Limits, which means we're not going to be able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you enjoy the conversation. We're going to be talking with several representatives from the Speed City Sisters in Crime about some exciting developments they've got going on. My guests are Michael Dabney, who is president of Speed City, the Speed City chapter of Sisters in Crime, Crystal Rhodes, who is a member, and her colleagues describe her as the instigator and an author and playwright, and Diana Catt, who is a board member of the Speed City Sisters in Crime. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
It's good to be here.
Let's start with first talk about what Sisters in Crime is. And I'd be interested also in what drew each of you to it. I'll start with Michael, but I want to hear everyone's path to belonging.
Well, I had written a mystery novel, it was a little more than 10 years ago, and there was at the Holiday Book Fair in 2007, I just went to go look around, and I met two people who are still members of the Speed City chapters of Sisters in Crime. And they said, you know, you like mysteries, and of course I did. And they said, why don't you come to a meeting? So 10 years ago, it was in January of 2008, I joined. And what Sisters in Crime is, it's an international organization of like 3,600 people, roughly, who love and support, have a great affection for mystery writing and support the women who write them. One of the things I love about it is that they truly believe in equity and equality and diversity, and it's why there are also men in Sisters in Crime, like myself, a Mr. Sister, as it were. And in our chapter, there are 43, 44 members, and probably 15 to 20% of them is like 5, 6, 7 men. It's a good chapter. I've been in the chapter for 10 years. As it turns out, I'm the first male president of our chapter. Yeah, so that's how I got into it.
Crystal, what was your path?
Well, my path was, I think I've been a member of about 3 years now. My writing partner and I, Lily Burnett Evans, we had written a cozy mystery called Grandmothers Incorporated, cozy mystery series about three crime-fighting grandmas. And it was pretty successful. It's still going pretty well. And we had written two of them, I think, by that time, two or three of them. And we decided that we needed a critiquing of it. We'd gone to book clubs and things, and they had said they were good books. Anyway, I can't even remember where we found out about it, Sisters in Crime. But it said it had a critique group. And Lily and I looked at each other and said, oh, okay, this is what we need to do. So that's what drew us to Sisters in Crime.
Diana.
I was attending a writers' conference in Chicago, and I went to a panel or a presentation by Brenda Stewart, and it's on the program that she was from Mooresville, and that's where I'm from, Mooresville, Indiana. And so I went up to her afterwards and was talking to her, and she suggested I join the local chapter of Sisters in Crime. And that was in 2006, I think. And so it's been really good for me, the critique group, for one thing, and all the publishing opportunities that we've had as members, and all the workshops and invited speakers that we have been really learning experiences.
What is the value? I'll stay with Diana, but I'd like to hear everybody's thoughts, because most people think of writing as a fairly solitary experience. You're by yourself, and used to be the piece of paper, but for a lot of people now it's the computer screen and all of that. What value do you get out of gathering with other writers?
Well, for one thing, if you're in a critique group, and if you're a writer, I absolutely recommend you join a critique group. That experience is invaluable, because as a writer, you know what you want to put down on the paper, and you know what you want to impart to the reader, but you don't really know whether the reader gets it the way you meant it until you have a reader. And so if you have a critique group, they give you feedback, and then you can go away realizing they got it, or, man, they're way off, you know, I'm way off. They didn't get what I meant, and you can make your corrections.
Crystal, how about you? What do you get out of it?
Once again, the critique group is invaluable to me. I've become a much better writer, and I've been writing plays and books for almost 20 years, plays for over 30 years. Mm-hmm. And this critique group has made me a much better writer. That's the total value for me, as well as fellow writers who I highly respect. They're very good writers.
Mm-hmm. Michael.
Well, Sisters in Crime, in general, in particular, I feel, and certainly in our chapter, they have a very engaging community of writers. And not all of them write mysteries, although mostly they do. And it's just good to be around other writers. And as both of both Crystal and Diana said, one of the best things is getting good critique. I mean, you as Diana said, you know what you want to say, but you know, you wonder, you know, is it coming across that way? And you're not. Most people are not really good editors of themselves, and I'm certainly not. And there are all sorts of things in my writing that I don't catch that a really good critique group does, and that improves. And it certainly improves my writing, and that's one of the main things I get from it.
So if people are listening right now and they think, well, I'd like to become a member, what does that involve? I mean, if someone wants to become a member of Sisters in Crime, the Speed City chapter, what do they have to do?
One of the other good things about it is not everyone who's a member is a writer. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few of the people who are merely readers. It's one of the... one of the aspects of the chapter. We meet once a month on the fourth Saturday of the month at the Barnes & Noble near Keystone at the Crossing. Our critique group meets at 10. Our business meeting is at 11:30. And then we always have a speaker. And the speaker is, of course, open to everyone who comes. And we have very good speakers, people who are writers, people, is just a very broad range of people who can impart knowledge to both readers and writers.
Who are some of the people who've spoken?
Oh, good heavens.
Hank
Phillippe Ryan. That's a very good one.
She's an Indiana girl from back. And Reese Bowman.
Reese Bowman. Yes, okay. She's a nationally known writer. One of the things that we do when we have writers, most of the time, probably 75% of the time, a speaker is from outside the chapter. But sometimes, if we have a member who has a special knowledge about something, my brain just went dead there. Mm-hmm. Like self-publishing, or in this mm-hmm. case, about writing plays. Mm-hmm. In April of last year, in 2007, our speaker was Crystal, and mm-hmm. she did a really good presentation about playwriting. And at the very end of it, she shocked all of us by saying, "The chapter should write a play." And we were thinking, we had none of us ever thought of that at all. It was like a shock. And but we took the challenge and we moved forward.
If you're just joining us, this is a special recorded No Limits, which means we're not able to take calls, emails, questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. We're talking with representatives from the Speed City chapter of Sisters in Crime about their chapter and about some big events coming up. Eventually, we're going to also start just talking about the enduring appeal of mysteries and mystery writing. So that's a cue. I'll go with Crystal on this one. There is a big event coming up on August 16th, the premiere of a play called Deadbeat. Talk to me a little bit about that, Crystal, about how that evolved. We know that the moment of conception was you dropping a bomb at a at a speech.
I didn't realize
that
it was a bomb. I just felt it was a business decision. I've always approached writing as a business from the very beginning when I first started out. And most artists do not take care of their business. And I've always been teased about that because I've always taken care of the business of writing. But I've always admired the talent that was in Sisters in Crime. And one of the members had, in the critique group, had presented a play and to us to critique. And I thought it was pretty good. It needed work. And some others had approached me about, I think I'll write a play, and asking me about it. Well, I get tired of people asking me about things. Mm-hmm. Do it. Mm-hmm. That's my recommendation. So I explained to the group that when you write a play, this is an ownership of property, and mm-hmm. you can make money on the ownership of your property. And they were enthusiastic about it. Sisters in Crime is a nonprofit organization, and for some reason, nonprofit organizations feel that you can't make money. You can't make a profit because it says nonprofit organization.
Yeah, it's a tax designation.
It doesn't
mean for loss.
And I've always said I've worked for nonprofit organizations most of my working career while I wasn't working for myself. And this organization took the challenge. I'm still amazed that they took the challenge to actually write this play. And they were, as far as I know, they were all novice, although Janet Williams, someone I think had told me she had
Full disclosure here, Janet works with me at the StateHouseFile.com in Franklin County. I got to put that out there. So.
She informed me, and someone else, I can't remember who else, and they had written church plays. And people kind of discount that when they tell me that. And I'm saying, well, it's a play. Mm-hmm. So you have written a play. And others who had not written a play at all, had not even thought about it. It just boggles my mind. To me, writing is writing. I've written it all. Mm-hmm. I've done it all. I mean, radio plays. I mean, mm-hmm. I've done it all. So I can't even comprehend not using your writing talents to go any area you want to. And I presented it after my presentation, and they took up the challenge, and they've taken it up very well. I'm really proud of them.
So, Michael, talk to me a little bit about what this play is. I want to be careful. I have read the play, people will enjoy it. It challenges you. So, and I don't want to say anything more than that. If you give anything away, it's on you. I'm not going to do. Okay. I'm not going to be the guilty party.
Deadbeat, which is the name of the play, is about two longtime friends, one named Abigail and one named Celeste, who come across the dead body of Abigail's husband, who is, like the play, a deadbeat. He's emotionally abusive and whatever. And over the course of the play, they, you know, explore their relationship to each other and try and figure out what should be the next thing that they should do when they have this body. But at the same time, both of the women tend to think the other woman is the killer. And so that's what the play is about.
And how many people were involved in the writing? Was it the entire chapter or was it
Diana? I think we started out with a group of about 12 or 15 people that expressed an interest in it, but it quickly whittled down because collaborative projects are difficult to work with, mm-hmm. especially with a lot of writers who are used to working solo. So we ended up with, maybe six or eight in the final group. Four of us met more often just because of our time schedules, and then we would send what we had accomplished that evening out to the rest of the group for critique.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with three members of the Speed City chapter of the Sisters in Crime about their new play and other big events. We're going to be talking about the enduring appeal of mystery writing, too. My guests are Michael Dabney, Crystal Rhodes, and Diana Catt. This is a recorded No Limits, which means we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we do hope you're enjoying the conversation. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking with three representatives of the Speed City chapter of Sisters in Crime today on No Limits. They are Michael Dabney, who is the chapter president, Crystal Rhodes, who is a member, and her colleagues say she is an instigator, and Diana Catt, who is a board member. This is a recorded No Limits, which means we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the discussion. So I'll start with Michael on this one. When we left, before we went to the break, we were talking about Deadbeat and sort of how it came together, and all the members. If people want to see this play, how do they go about doing that?
Well, we had applied for and were accepted into this year's Indie Fringe Festival. Indie Fringe runs from August 16th through the 26th. And there'll be six performances of Deadbeat. If you go to indiefringe.org and then scroll down to where it says Deadbeat, you can get the exact schedules. You can buy tickets online also at the Fringe. They are a general admission is $15. Students and senior citizens are $12. So the premiere will be on the 16th. At 9 p.m. In the Basile Theater at the Indie Fringe, which is at Sinclair, 719 East Sinclair, which is where Massachusetts, St. Clair, and College come together, and that's where the Fringe Theater is.
Okay. And you say there are six performances. Was it difficult to cast? I mean, you know, it's one thing when you write a play. But I can see there are, you know, it's going to be an interesting challenge for the actors here because there's a certain amount of information you have to present about the characters and there's a certain amount you have to withhold through it without actually seeming to lie or contradict the character's essence. Diana, you're nodding here. You know
I'm
what
nodding.
I'm talking about.
I do.
Yeah.
The luck we had was we have a wonderful director, Deborah Asante. She's a local director. Probably a lot of people have heard of her. And she has good networks and knows who the actors are that could handle something like what they'll see in this play. And she's got a wonderful cast assembled. They're doing a fantastic job. I was allowed to go to a couple of rehearsals, but they asked for writers not to come anymore. I don't know if that's a common thing or not, but it's okay. I'll see it when it comes out. But so far, so good.
Crystal, where does the money that's going to be raised from this go?
It's going to Sisters in Crime for our activities. Michael could probably speak to what some of the activities are, but it will help Sisters in Crime, which is a nonprofit organization.
And do you have funding other than doing events like this, or does most of it come from membership dues, Michael?
No, we, although this play is a first for us, actually, as far as I can tell, it's a first for any Sisters in Crime chapter at all. But our chapter has done a number of anthologies over the last 10 years. We've done five, and the sixth one will come out this coming November. We support a lot of the activities of the chapter through the fundraising that we get through the sale of our anthologies. And that's what we will we're hoping to do. Amongst the it pays for when we particularly when we have an out of town speaker, it helps pay for that. At least every other year we have a workshop, usually a retreat at Bradford Woods, and it goes to covering the cost of renting Bradford Woods and feeding us and getting speakers to come in and talk to us. So those are two of the big things that we do.
And I realized I'm not sure we got diverted in the conversation. I did ask earlier if someone wants to become a member of Sisters in Crime, if there's someone who's got an interest. Diana, you're
I'm actually the membership chairman this year.
Okay. And is there a website?
There is. We have a website. It's Speed City, Indiana. No. Here it is right here.
Okay.
Speed City, SistersInCrime.org.
Okay.
And there's a membership application on there. And it tells you where to submit your dues. And to join our chapter, it's $15. But you also have to join the National Sisters in Crime, which I think is $50.
$50, so it's a total of $65.
$65.
And that's annual, not...
That's annual.
That's annual, so it's not something you're going to get dinged every month or something
like
that.
Oh, no. It's annual. And it's fairly inexpensive as far as other writers' organizations go.
So let me... Crystal, you made the point that that... many writers don't look at the financial aspect of this. And it's one of the things that I'd like to ask each of the three of you why you write, because when you look at the economics, a lot of them are brutal for writers. I think it was the Writers Guild, did a study a few years ago and found out that there are 600,000 published authors in the United States and Canada, and only 3,000 of them don't have day jobs. And that includes some of the ones, like I remember the New Yorker doing a story about James Wilcox years ago, who literally was living at a subsistence or poverty level so he could write all the time. Why do you think it is so hard for people to make a living writing? And what is it then that... it compels so many people to want to write? I'll start with Crystal. Yeah.
Well,
I'd like
born
to hear everybody's
to write.
Yeah.
That's and you'll hear a lot of writers say that. I've been writing since I was 8 years old, so I can't even comprehend not writing. I've made quite a bit of money as a playwright. I didn't even know playwrights didn't get produced. I mean, literally, I didn't. Every play I've ever written has gotten produced. So it just never even occurred to me that they wouldn't get produced. Am I a millionaire? No. I've always had another job. My family told me, get your degree so you won't starve to death. And that has helped. But I've lived quite a few years just working for myself because I have approached it as an part of my income. So it's the artiste aspect of it that I know a lot of young, well, not just young ones, as I was coming up and as I was writing, I would tell them to approach it as a career. Like, I've written for a newspaper. I've been a columnist. I've been a theater critic. There are aspects of writing that you can do what you love to do and still write. And I wonder sometimes, is it just the limitation that society puts on us as writers, the starving artists, which I've never bought into. I had no intention of starving for anybody. So I think sometimes we play into that. We believe that. It just never occurred to me. I left Indianapolis 30-something years ago to go to California to write. That's what I went for. And in the years I was there, that's what I did. Like I told you, I did all aspects. So if there's any young writers out there, don't limit yourself as a writer. You can write almost anything. I have done it.
Michael, what motivates you?
Oh, that's a difficult question.
Well, there's a reason the show is called No Limits.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I was I worked as a daily journalist for many years, and about 10 years ago, a little more than that, I guess in 2007, I decided to take up a challenge of writing fiction, and I find it very fulfilling. I mean, I would like to make more money from it than I currently do, but that's not the thing that motivates me. It's just coming up with a good story and seeing it brought to conclusion. One of the things I don't understand, and I'll probably contradict Crystal here, but I don't necessarily think I was born to write, and in some ways I don't think that I like writing. What I do like, I really, really love, is having written. Mm-hmm. You know, the process of it is like, sometimes I was sitting at my computer last night, and I was writing a short story that I need to give to my critique group today, and it was like, you know, banging my head against the wall. But when I was done, I thought, oh, that's not bad. That's not that bad. So it's you know, the more the finished product than the process of writing that I particularly like.
Yeah, two quotes are coming to mind while you were talking. The first one is, and I'm forgetting the French writer who said rather famously, writing is easy. All you have to do is slice open a vein and let it drip onto the page.
Yeah.
And the other one that speaks more to Crystal's point is that comes from the mystery novelist Elmore Leonard, who tells a joke in his book Get Shorty, as one of his characters offer it up, that is one that only people who've made a living with their pens can appreciate. The character asks, what kind of writing pays best, and then answers the question himself by saying, ransom notes, which is a good line. Diana, what brought you to writing? I mean, what drives you?
It's kind of like Crystal, where I've always been writing, but I have a different drive, I guess, than Crystal. She's trying to make money, and I love that. I mean, I just love when she challenges us to do that, because I was just writing to get my ideas out, and they set on my computer or in a box in my room or somewhere. But that was one of the nice things about joining Sisters in Crime, was that I get encouraged to submit the stories somewhere and get them out there in the public. I'm still real, not real good at spending my time doing that, because I do have a daytime job and it keeps me very busy.
And when you say that you're not good at, do you mean not good at submitting your work? Or
not good at
advocating?
No, I can write really good query letters, and it's just I don't spread it out enough. I don't send out 25. I might send out one and see what happens, and if they don't respond, I'll say, okay, maybe they'll respond next year. You know, I'm not highly motivated to pursue that publication, and I should be. I just need Crystal around me more often to tell me to do that.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with three members of the Speed City Sisters in Crime chapter about the new play they've got, a new anthology also that is coming out in time for Christmas shopping this year. This is a recorded No Limits, which means that we are not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. And the thing that always fascinates me when I'm talking with writers is almost inevitably it comes back. We get started because there was someone we read who tripped the trigger for us and said, oh, wow, I wish I could do that. Or just that's a world I'd like to enter into, or something that brings to life the, you know, just the sheer joy of reading. Who was that writer, or who were those writers for you, Diana?
Oh, I really liked Sarah Paretsky. I read everything that she wrote. She's a great writer.
And also one of the founders, really, of Sisters in Crime.
Yes. I actually attended a scientific conference back in the time. Do you remember when they cloned the sheep, Dolly? Mm-hmm. That was kind of a famous thing. So I was attending a conference, and because I'm also a scientist, but but they were talking about the techniques for cloning, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is science fiction come to life. And then all of a sudden I had this fantastic idea for a novel. So that was the first novel that I actually wrote, which is stuck in a drawer somewhere and hasn't seen the light of day. But yeah, other writers, Stephen King was a big inspiration to me as well.
Crystal, how about you? Who were the writers that inspired you?
Maya Angelou. She's a Renaissance woman, and I wanted to be her. I wanted to do everything she did. Plus, I like Stephen King, but he scares me.
What was it about Maya that that spoke
like
to you so powerfully?
Like I said, she was a Renaissance woman. And I just read everything about her, and I tried to read everything that she wrote. She did it all. She was an actress, a director. Like, as you see, my personality, I like to do it all.
Yeah.
And she did it all. She made, I saw that it was possible when I read about her and when I read her work.
Okay. Michael.
In fiction, it's kind of hard to say. I think probably John Le Carré would be it for me. Probably my favorite book, one that I read probably every other year or so, is Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, because the main character, John Smiley, George Smiley, I'm sorry, is just such a perfect character. And
what makes him perfect?
Because he's not James Bond. He's so different and antithetical of James Bond, except the fact that he's brilliant. He's just a brilliant, middle-aged, bespectacled guy who is brilliant at what he does. And, he does have a flaw, and that is Lady Smiley, Jane Smiley, Anne Smiley, that's his wife's name.
Smiley's a novelist from Iowa.
that is his Achilles heel. But I don't know. I just love Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy a great deal, and more than anything, I mean, there are lots of suspense writers that I particularly like, but one that really resonates with me is John Le Carré.
And at what age were you when you first began to explore?
The first time I read it, probably was in the mid-70s, about the time that Tinker Tailor came out. I went back and read others, like The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and other Le Carré books. But, he was the one that, I mean, I always liked reading from the time I was in high school on. I liked reading, but nothing particularly stuck out in my head, although probably current events sorts of mysteries more than anything else. But when I read Tinker Tailor, I've just loved it. I have several copies of it at home. The first copy I had is in paperback, and it's all dog-eared.
The spine is broken and
all
of that.
Yeah, and I really do not like ever breaking a spine, but this one is broken really badly. But it's probably why I have actually three copies of that novel.
So, and we're getting coming up on a break. Are there any writers that you just can't stand to read, or that you avoid? I mean, what tripped the trigger was your reference that seemed to be Michael, that there was a fair amount of disdain. When you made reference to the Bond books, and of course, the Bond in the books is considerably different from the Bond in the movies. So the Bond in the books is a pretty flawed character too.
Yeah. There are books that my daughters like reading that I truly cannot get through. One of my daughters loved the Twilight series, and as much as I tried, I could not get through any of the Twilights at all.
No, I think you're not alone there, sadly.
So there's not a lot that I couldn't do.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Michael Dabney, Crystal Rhodes, and Diana Catt. They are all members of the Speed City Sisters in Crime chapter. We've been talking about the new play they've got coming out on premiering on August 16th, and a new anthology that will appear this fall. This is a recorded No Limits, which means we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but I do hope you're enjoying the discussion. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to this recorded version of No Limits. Today on No Limits, we're talking about mystery writing with three members of the Sisters in Crime Speed City chapter. They are Michael Dabney, Crystal Rhodes, and Diana Catt. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying this lively conversation about one of my favorite literary forms. So we've talked about sort of the specifics, the play, the anthology, but one of the things I'd like to talk about, in part because it fascinates me, is if you go into any bookstore, mystery novels are always a huge section in the bookstore. There aren't quite as many as there used to be because bookstores have had some economic pressures. But in many cities in the country, there used to be bookstores that were dedicated exclusively to mystery novels in ways that you don't necessarily see other genres being represented. So I'm going to start with Diana on this one. What is the enduring appeal of the mystery?
I think it has to do with solving a puzzle. Most people like to have their brain engaged and figure out who did it. And that's always fun as a reader, and it's fun as a writer to try and get all that information in there. Mystery is more than as a category. It includes traditional mysteries and also suspense and thrillers. And those other two, the suspense can get your blood going and get your fear up there, and same thing with thrillers. They are a lot more scary, and people like to be scared. I think they enjoy that.
Crystal, what do you think is the reason people are drawn to mysteries in the fashion?
Well, I can only speak for myself. I know, as sharp as my mind, I've been reading. I remember as a child reading Sherlock Holmes. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I'd read volumes of them. And always trying to think ahead. What were the clues that he was giving me so that I could solve the mystery quicker? So, for me, it was just sharpening my mind.
Michael.
I really do think it is the, whodunit aspect of the story. Whenever I'm reading a mystery or if I'm at a, particularly if I'm at a play, I'm always thinking, okay, was that a clue? I like to figure it out ahead of time because I always pat myself on the back at the end. When I read a mystery and I didn't get it, I think back at all the times that there were clues, small clues, that I didn't get. And I just find that fascinating. So I think overall it is the appeal of the puzzle, as Diana put it, and trying to put it together and figure out who did it.
How much of it is also, though, I mean, that's a plot-driven thing. But it seems to me like, and I love mysteries. I read a lot of them. Probably the three writers that mystery writers whose work I've consumed and in some cases read the books multiple times. James Lee Burke, mm-hmm. William Kent Kruger, and Walter Mosley. And with all three of those writers, you've got flawed protagonists. But the other piece that I think really draws me is that the place, the setting, is almost like a character in the books itself. How much of that drives the appeal to that it's a chance to step into another life, a chance to visit other places that we may not know or know only as tourists. Diana, you're making the mistake of making eye contact with me. So I'm going to go with you first.
I think that's very important, and it's a good sign of an excellent author, regardless of the genre, whether you're in mystery or in some sci-fi where you've got another world building. It's the feelings that the reader has for the characters and how committed they are to wanting that character to get out of whatever trouble they're in. And it can transcend genre, romance and Westerns, all of those. The good authors make the reader feel like they're there. They're part of the whole scene, and they're really committed to finding out what happened to those characters.
Mm-hmm. Crystal, how important is setting and the sort of having a protagonist that one can, if not identify with, be fascinated by?
It's very important to me. You mentioned one of my favorite mystery writers, which is Walter Mosley. His Easy Rollin character. I like the fact that he was an African-American man, flawed, just average African-American man who wanted to make some money on the side.
Yeah.
And so he
yeah,
goes
that part
out
of it spoke to you, clearly. Yeah.
He solves mysteries, and it's in early California, and I like history. I mean, not that it's that old, but I agree. I love the setting, and I like that character. And he was the first mystery I read that had an African-American man as the chief protagonist. So I hooked on to him like, oh, I like this.
Well, and I remember all of the books have been very well written, but, in part, I think the first novel, Devil in a Blue Dress, just exploded because it was written not just from a point of view, but also using language in a way that we had not seen in mystery novels before, that sort of reinforced all of the tensions within the book. Michael, how important are character and setting for you?
Setting, not so much. Certainly I don't think of it so much as either a reader or a writer, actually. I tend to write more character-driven stories. And so the character is very, very important, who they are and, what they're about. I try to have them interesting and not just two-dimensional. So they do have goods and good points and positive points, but also negative points. So I think that mystery novels, to me, that are best are very much character driven. I don't tend to care as much about the setting if the character is really compelling.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with three members of the Speed City chapter of Sisters in Crime about mysteries, about a play that they have that will be premiering on August 16th here in Indianapolis. This is a recorded No Limits, which means that we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you are enjoying the conversation. When we're looking at mysteries, and I'm digging back here, I remember years ago when I worked at the newspaper, I think it was the mystery writers Nancy Picard and Jeremiah Healy came to town for an event, and I interviewed them and then talked to – they went out to – back in the days when there were still Borders bookstores, the Borders that used – the very old Borders that used to be at Castleton Square, and was talking with a guy about why he was drawn – to mysteries. He said part of it is, too, that they have a structure that is not in place in a lot of modern fiction now, that, there's a beginning and a middle and an end to the story, that often there is some sort of, even if there's ambiguity at the end, there's still some sort of resolution that you feel like you have experienced an actual story. How much of that is true, do you think, in terms of what draws people to mysteries, the sense that you do get to at least complete part of the journey?
I think that's really important to have the mystery itself resolved at the end and have all the loose ends tied up. I mean, that's very satisfactory for the reader to be able to explain everything. I get frustrated if something is left hanging or missing by the end of the book. That would be a mark against that author for buying future stories from that person. So I personally like resolution at the end.
Although I guess, isn't it Raymond Chandler in The Big Sleep realized after someone confronted him on it that he had absolutely no idea who'd killed one of the people in the in the book, that it was a mystery even to him. But is that sense that the sort of implied promise here that you are going to have some idea of what happened part of the appeal, Michael?
Yeah, I think that's very important. It's part of the whole puzzle thing and why people are drawn to it and putting the puzzle together and so that the puzzle is complete and there's not, you know, a piece of this puzzle that, you know, was left in the box or on the floor somewhere. But I think that with ambiguity I wrote a short story that hasn't been published. Oh, no, take that back. Yes, it is. In one of our anthologies, the last one that came out, that's called The Fine Art of Murder. And the anthology, that's the anthology, but my story in this is called Callipygian. And I don't, within the structure of the story, the people in that universe, they don't know who is the killer. But at the very end, I couldn't cheat the reader. I revealed to the reader who the killer was. And so I think that I would have been cheating the reader if in the very end that I didn't do that. Although in the story itself, the people in the story, they don't know who the killer is. But ultimately, I revealed it to the reader.
Crystal, what do you think? Is it that the fact that there is resolution in most mysteries that adds to the appeal?
Well, as I said, I only speak for myself, but yes, and it has to make sense too, because if it doesn't make sense to me, then I'm never reading another book by that particular writer. But yes, resolution is very important as far as I'm concerned.
When you start to write, I'll stay with Crystal on this, and you're working on a mystery. Is it a puzzle you have to solve yourself, or do you generally know where it's going to go? Talked with other writers, and I get as many different answers as there are different writers. Some of them say, I start writing and I have no idea where it's going to end, where these characters are going to take me.
Well, I write with a partner, as I said. I write mysteries with a partner. I have another. Mm. I also write romantic suspense. I write that alone. Mm. But with my partner, she and I do an entire outline, and each character, we know everything about that person. So we're writing one now. We have no idea where it's going, but like with our Grandmothers Incorporated series, we almost automatically knew. So because we had outlined, we knew the characters, and then once you do the first, we did our first book, and we knew the characters so well, like the rest of them were just, it's just repetitious, really, just putting them in different situations. We always know what's going to happen. We always know our characters, and we always know how it's going to end. But we do a full outline and characterization, profiles of each character.
Michael, how about you? When you're writing a story, do you know where it's going to go, or is that part of the process of discovery, too?
It's a little of both, actually. I don't necessarily know what the very end is, but I generally know going in who the killer is. I mean, if I'm writing a murder mystery, I didn't tend to know who the main character is and who the killer is. But how it's specifically going to end, I don't know. I don't particularly care for outlining. A lot of people do, but it depends. But I will outline. I'll sketch out something. if I have to write a great deal in a fairly short period of time, because then I have to know, really do know where I'm going. But as a whole, I tend to be a seat of the pants sort of writer. I have a character, I know how it's going to start, and I tend to write in continuity from beginning to end, and then, you know, find out things along the way. But I tend to know pretty much, not necessarily the exact final scene, but I tend to know who the killer is going to be.
Diana, how about you?
I don't know who the killer is usually when I start. That's part of the fun for me, is to figure it out as I'm going along. And sometimes that can get you into trouble because, you know, you might think you're at a dead end and then you've got to maneuver things and figure out how to get around that spot.
That you've written yourself into a box, as it were.
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah. But that's part of the problem there, too. So that's the fun part, is trying to get out of that box and make it make sense.
We are getting close on time here, so I want to get back to talking about the play real quickly, Deadbeat. Where is it premiering and when, Michael? And if people want to attend, how do they go about buying tickets?
Well, Deadbeat, which was written and produced by the Speed City Chapter of Sisters in Crime and is being directed by Deborah Sante. The first performance is April the 16th at 9 p.m.
August the 16th.
I'm sorry. Did I say that?
Yeah, we haven't invented a Wayback Machine yet.
August 16th. The first performance is at 9. There'll be a performance on the 16th, the 18th, and the 20th. All those are at 9. And then on the 23rd, 24th, and 26th, and they'll be at 7:30, and then at 6, and then 7:30 on those days. All the performances will be at the Basile Theater at Indie Fringe, because this is part of the Indie Fringe Festival, and the theater is at 719 East St. Clair downtown, right at Massachusetts Avenue. You can get tickets at IndieFringe.org.
Okay, and also Speed City Sisters in Crime Chapter has a new anthology coming out this autumn.
Yes, I was co-editor on that anthology, and it's a collection of 12 different mysteries that were written by chapter members. And at the end, we have recipes related to each mystery. So that's kind of fun. Christmas recipes.
So you can eat after.
I'm trying to talk them into doing a launch party with food, but I don't know if that'll happen.
Okay.
But it'll be out in time for Christmas.
And Diana, real quickly, if people who are listening to this want to become members again of Speed City Sisters in Crime Chapter, how do they go about doing that, and what are the costs?
SpeedCitySistersInCrime.org is the website. It's $15 for chapter membership, $50 for the national dues, which you also have to join the national chapter or national organization. And the membership application form is on the website, and you just mail the contact person your check.
And the URL again is?
www.speedcitysistersincrime.org.
And that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Michael Dabney, Crystal Rhodes, and Diana Catt, all of the Speed City Sisters in Crime Chapter. Good luck with the premiere of your play. I have enjoyed talking with you. Also like to thank our listeners for joining us. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.